Inheritor by Gav Thorpe, read by John Banks. The abyssal citulate would come. Orisons of pain would call him. Lamentable prayers would build the bridge. The ecstasy of faith would open the gate. As he had been instructed, so Torquil Eliphas would obey. As had been laid down in the architectus paternus, so the word-bearer would act. Soon, he told his companions, soon the consecration will be upon us, and our labours fulfilled. Glories undreamed of, and rewards everlasting shall be ours. Clad in armour of dark red and gold, the drab plate of the old legion obscured beneath layers of enamel, just as the old rites had been replaced by new sacraments, Eliphas epitomised the grandeur and celebration of the reborn 17th Legion. The new lacquer work blotted out his old hierarchical symbols, but in gold and rubies was picked out the icon of the Ark of Testimony chapter. He was chapter master no longer. Soon he would be so much more. He bore a large mace, as much a scepter of office as a weapon. From the pierced head drifted clouds of crimson incense, whose sweet scent left a bitter aftertaste. Its specific compound had been developed to induce a slightly stimulated state, even in the adapted physiology of a space marine. Near constant exposure left Eliphas twitchy, his pupils dilated to the extent that his eyes appeared black. He was never still, his gaze always moving from one point to another, fingers flexing on the haft of the mace and fidgeting with the snakeskin-bound grip of the pistol holstered at his hip. Eliphas's roaming stare moved across the edifice he had raised, ignoring his two fellow word-bearers as he spoke.
Now is the greatest moment of our lives. Now our service shall be renewed and our efforts redoubled that we might herald the epoch of changes. An empire laid waste, its ruins a dedication to the abyssal citulate. 500 worlds drowned in blood, scoured by fire in revenge for fair Monarchia.
It is not enough, Inheritor, growled Acton.
Like his commander, Curior Acton wore the new livery of the Legion. On a long stave he bore an icon wrought from 8 gilded skulls, set upon an octagon of silvered thigh bones. When he spoke, the vexillary's deep voice was edged with bitterness.
1,000 worlds would not repair such hurt. The wound is in our souls where no salve can reach.
The third warrior of the 17th wore the original grey of the Legion, the surface of his armour marked by scripture dedicated to the Emperor, now struck through in many tracts, the meanings of others amended by subtly ironic additions that turned entreaties into insults, benedictions into curses. Though outwardly the least changed of the trio, Gorvael Yoth was the most learned in the works of Lorgar and Cor Faeron. While it had been Eliphas's energy and vision that had brought the Templum de Monarchia into existence, it had been shaped by the knowledge and calculations of Yoth. Eliphas said nothing as he admired the construction wrought by their slaves, rendered breathless by its magnitude and magnificence. If one looked closely, there might have been a wet glimmer in his eye, though he would have claimed it was simply the reflection of Cronus's sun. The Cathedral of Impurity towered 200 metres into the sky, built from the ruins of the flattened city of Typhades on the Deimos Peninsula. Though masonry and mortar formed its foundation, looted from court precincts and tithe yards, senatorial palaces and communal solisternia, the true beauty of the edifice was in the human materials bound within its construction. Their sacrifice to honour the abyssal citulate would remain forever, an immortal end for benighted mortals. Eliphas looked upon their physical remains, and for a moment he almost envied them their eternal peace. Some had been preserved intact, particularly the youngest, their skin like alabaster, their innocent faces raised to the sky with expressions of beatific torment. When he closed his eyes and pictured them, Eliphaz could hear the screams of despairing adulation trapped within the transparent lacquer that coated each of the 1,000 cherubic figures arrayed in a tightening spiral around the immense pilaster. The chorus of their death shrieks vibrated on the very edge of hearing, unheard by the mundane, but projecting a clear signal that rippled out across the Empyrean. It would carry Eliphaz's message to the abyssal Sigillate, and the favour of the great master would fall like manna upon him. The other 9,000 souls bound within the awe-inspiring monument of the Templum had been rendered down to their essence, to the bones upon which weak flesh had been hung. Of these, 3,000 were intact skeletons, arrayed artfully as a parade of the dead, dancing and feasting as they marched into the heavens. The artistry belonged to Eliphaz, but the precisely calculated angles of each body belonged to Gorvael Yoth. Between them, they combined the science and aesthetic of the immaterial, that mystical yet attainable balance point between the everyday and the divine, the real and unreal, the mortal universe and the warp. The Golden Gate, it was called colloquially by the lower ranks, a crude euphemism, but one that served its purpose. The Templum Demonarchia would be like a gate once activated, and through it would arrive the abyssal Sigillate to lay down praises upon those that had built such a wonder. Of the remaining cadavers, all but 8 were no more than skulls used to pave the road before the macabre procession, and to act as the sacred constellations in the sky above them on this arcane tableau. The last handful adorned the primordial sun of Acton's standard, which would be set upon the monument at the required moment, a lightning rod for all the powers of the Demonarchia. Thus would the bridge be built and the path laid. The entire tower throbbed with latent energy, silently singing with the souls of the blessed deceased. Eliphaz could only imagine what it would feel like when the Templum was empowered. With each passing moment, he admired anew the wonderfully grotesque lines and confluences of the strangely angled edifice. In places, it seemed to bear teeth made of ribs. In others, it was as flat and smooth as the gulf between stars, the dark marble seeming to swallow his gaze. Elliptical spirals and geometric concatenations drew the eye in strange directions, making even Eliphaz's head spin, despite his artificially augmented sense of balance. The rapidly narrowing point of the tower, the forced perspective against the overcast sky, drew one up into the heavens with vertiginous swiftness. And it was still not complete. A scaffold of wooden towers and decks linked by rope ladders jutted impossibly from the narrow but soaring building. Pulleys and tackles hung like spiders' webs used to move the immense blocks of basalt and granite, sandstone and marble from the base of the tower to their final positions. Shaped by a team of 73 masons, many of whom had been only too willing to work to Yoth's plans to build the tower rather than become part of it, each block had been stained pale red, anointed with blood from the sacrificed. They were fixed in place with mortar mixed from the same and liberally thickened with bone powder. Thousands laboured at the winches to manoeuvre the great slabs and bricks into place. They worked without harness or rope. More than 100 had fallen to their deaths in the last 2 days, and a similar number had been crushed against the growing walls by swaying blocks or bludgeoned by snapping scaffold. All in all, 100,000 souls of Kronos had given up their tedious mortal existence for the greater glory of the abyssal Sigillate. The last of the foursome viewing this majestic enterprise was Vostigar Catacult Eris. He was a little shorter than Eliphaz, by just 2 or 3 centimetres, but was broader in shoulder and chest. His armour was layered with a polished sheen of gritty white ceramite, contrasting with his blue steel pauldrons and gauntlets. Upon his shoulder was wrought in brass a pair of jaws closing about a planet, the symbol of the 12th Legion. If one did not know his allegiance from such colours and icons, it would have been made obvious by his half-shaved skull, the left side of which was studded with exposed metallic implants. Mood inhibitors and adrenal boosters, Erez and his brother World Eaters refer to them as the Butcher's Nails, and seemed oddly proud of the fact that their brains had been tampered with. For Eliphaz, such mechanical interference was a contravention of the bond between the corpus and the soul, but he was wise enough not to cause any insult to the temperamental captain. Erez stood with arms crossed and looked at the templum. Two curved chainswords hung at his hips, and the right vambrace of his warplate was mounted with a bolt gun mechanism, fed by a belt of ammunition linked to his modified backpack. The plates at his elbows and knees, as well as his boots, sported serrated blades specially angled to allow him to use his arms and legs as weapons in close fighting.
"This is what you wanted all the bodies for?"
the World Eater asked. He turned his incredulous gaze on Eliphaz.
"It's ugly. Why would you build such an abomination? What does it do?"
"Do?"
Yoth sneered and turned on the World Eater before Eliphaz could reply.
"It channels, it absorbs, it magnifies, it contorts, it takes the energies of the other realm and spirals them through a complex system of decantations and alphanumerical misty rhythms, until it creates a condensed immaterial formwork derived from quarto potentials bonded to a semi-scaling decline rift. It is a construction of epic nature. Those physical properties you deem ugly are mirrored by a conversely beautiful but invisible balance and poise of preternatural accuracy and function. One might just as well set eyes upon the opening blossom of a dawn rose and complain that the edges were a little ragged."
Yoth turned breathlessly back to his creation and was clearly about to continue, but Eliphaz intervened.
"It is equally a beacon, a bridge, and a gateway, kinsman," he said.
He understood his companion's frustration, but it served nobody's purpose to antagonize their ally. Trying to explain to the purely military mind of Erez the etheric interplays brought about by the unique construction of the Templum was akin to describing the glory of a rainbow to a blind fish. He waved a hand in agitation as he struggled to find the words that would convey the multidimensional elegance of it.
It is both the messenger and the message, the herald and the clarion, the slaver and the slave."
"I see,"
said Erez, tapping the fingers of one hand on his arm as he looked again at the huge tower.
"I thought it was supposed to be some kind of teleporter."
Eliphaz cringed inwardly at the simplistic nature of Erez's worldview, but managed to smile.
"Aye, in a very distant way, it is."
"Why do we need one?"
asked Erez. He opened his arms and gestured towards their surroundings. Typhades was a desolate ruin for 5 kilometers in every direction.
"You have 200 warriors. I have 5 times that number. The people of Cronus are broken. What need do we have of a giant mystical teleporter?"
"Cronus is a step, a means to a greater end. When the abyssal citulate comes before us, we shall be ushered into the new dawn. Forget the petty ambitions of simple conquest, Erez. Not just the fiefdoms of Gilliman, but all of the Emperor's domain shall be ours for the taking. Our goal is not the defeat of a single people. It is the avenging of the Emperor's betrayal of our legion. No more will we be taken as fools, the lives of our brethren expended for the grandeur of an uncaring god. Not again shall we suffer the ignominy of serving lesser mortals."
"And your tower will do that, will it?"
Erez shrugged.
"How do you turn it on?"
"In all bargains there is a price. It is paid in blood, sweat, and toil."
"I see plenty of sweat and toil," said Erez.
He grinned savagely.
"When do you need more blood?"
"So, their plan has worked?" asked Kordal Arruka.
Eris' second-in-command did not look convinced as the two of them studied the orbital sensor sweeps at the control station in the back of the Achilles-pattern land raider transport. A prized headquarters vehicle gifted to him by none other than Amanda's Tyre of the Imperial Fists 14 years and an age ago when they had fought together at Varleth Gorge. Aruka had slain Captain Nordas Vaya out of hand when he had tried to insist that Eris left the transport behind when departing with Eliphas. It had been a good signal of loyalty on his part.
Perhaps,
Eris conceded. He looped back the data readings as he continued.
I admit, I was confused at first when Eliphas had insisted that we allow a few of the Ultramarines garrison to escape Cronus on that commandeered warp trawler. It seemed folly to spare them in itself, and doubly so because they would doubtless take word of what occurred back to their commanders. I argued that the Ultramarines would surely respond, and that we lacked the resources for a swift conclusion to the planetary occupation.
Aruka nodded.
I thought it oddly diplomatic of you at the time. You should have just taken the idiot's head. The will of Angron was most specific, my brother. We were to extend our full cooperation to the sons of Lorgar. That we were saddled with this foam-mouthed disciple of madness doesn't alter anything. He was exceptionally patronizing, Captain. He talked to us as though we were simpletons. He was, and he did. And but for the demands of the Primarch, I would have ended him there and then. But you must remember, my brother, that words and deeds are not the same.
Eris tapped a finger to his implant.
Rage begets rage. That is the pit that awaits us. I have warned you before that we should not waste the gifts of the butcher's nails on inconsequential matters. In most concerns, we must kill cold and kill clean. Show no remorse, but also feel no pleasure. Overuse of the implants reduces their effect with time, I believe. You are most peculiar for a world-eater, Captain. There are few that share your view on the nails. Which explains why I've been attached to these mumbling word-bearer morons, rather than fighting alongside our Lord Angron.
Eris paused and checked the chronomark on the orbital readings. 4 hours old. Why had Eliphas not released them sooner?
Many have thought me a fool, my brother. Their corpses have been forgotten. Eliphas courts disaster when his tongue runs away from him, but he knows that he needs me. It matters not whether I believe his great temple will bring their deliverer or not. He believes it, and that makes him beholden to us. Look at these time codes,
said Aruka.
The Ultramarines' response force must already be in range of the defense stations, but we receive no word that they have opened fire. It seems foolish to allow them to land without contest. That is because we are merely ignorant warriors, my brother,
said Eris. He wound the readings forward and pointed to a screen.
The drop assault is imminent. Their blood on our ground. That is what the word-bearers desire. To slay them in orbit, to scatter their atoms to the void, serves no purpose to our incense-huffing companion.
Eris turned and opened the assault ramp of the Achilles, flooding the interior with daylight. He strode out with Aruka at his heels and looked up. There was a telltale glimmer in the upper skies. The first glint of descending drop pods would have been missed by any less experienced warrior. About him were arrayed his 1,000 warriors stationed in and around the Templum. Linked by artificial causeways to the tower and each other, 8 bunker-like outbuildings guarded the approach to the main gatehouse, forming an abyssal star, as Yoth had termed it. To Eris, it was simply a convenient line of defence. World Eater squads were positioned in the fortifications and amongst the ruins further out from the grotesque edifice. He looked at it now. The construction had been completed 5 days ago, the third after receiving confirmation from Eliphas that the Ultramarines had returned and that the incoming task force numbered only 2 warships of any size. Had the Ultramarines taken the threat at Cronus seriously, the Wordbearers and World Eaters might well have faced several thousand warriors rather than a mere demi-company.
"They come!"
he warned his legionaries across the Vox, drawing his chainsabers.
"Remember the request of the Wordbearer. Slay only in the precinct of the Templum. Allow some to enter."
He lowered his voice and addressed Aruka.
"A battle barge and a strike cruiser. No more than 500 warriors at most. It seems that Eliphas's gambit has paid off. Concealing our presence has caused the enemy to underestimate the strength required to retake Cronus. Gilliman's sons are about to receive a hot welcome."
"It feels counter to all of my instinct and training to willingly leave enemy to the rear," said Aruka.
"We must trust the Wordbearers."
"Why?"
The inquiry took Eris by surprise, not because it was a bad question, but because it had not occurred to him before. It took him some time to think of an appropriate answer.
Because, if we cannot, this entire endeavor has been a monument to Eliphas's vanity and nothing else. If that is the case, I shall present his head to Angron myself."
Aruka nodded, accepting his captain's wisdom without comment. He pulled on his helm, its faceplate daubed with a red handprint across the snout and left eye. It had once been a bloody mark left by the first Raven Guard that Aruka had gutted at Istvan, but the blood had dried and flaked away over time, and so he had decided to commemorate the moment in more permanent fashion. He was not alone. There were other affectations, some far more disturbing, creeping in across the formal blue and white of the Legion. Eris did not mind these slips in uniform discipline. There was little enough incentive for his warriors to band together as it was. They had heard nothing from their Primarch in over 40 days, nor from Legion Command. The presence of Captain Vostigar Catacult Eris was all that reminded them that they were World Eaters at all, and he was not about to risk a mutiny by remarking on the daubed slogans and additions made by his warriors. The burning lights of the incoming drop pods and landing craft grew brighter.
"I wonder what it feels like,"
said Aruka.
"What's that?"
"Making a drop assault without the nails. I've always been too lost by the time I even stepped aboard to worry about the danger of plunging from orbit onto an enemy position. These sons of Macragge know exactly what they are doing, all the way down."
Eris did not reply. His implants were starting to respond to the change in his physiology and brain activity as the prospect of battle approached. His adrenal surge was already boosted by his Space Marine augmentations. On top of that, the butcher's nails were fizzing in the meat of his mind. He shuddered and bared his teeth, suppressing a growl. It was too soon. The key to using the nails properly was not to become a mindless slayer, as much as many in his legion allowed themselves. There was a technique, a pattern to follow, that allowed the implant to peak in its effect at just the right moment. The trick was to hold back on the rise to the top of the wave, and then allow oneself to succumb fully, riding it back down into oblivion. He knew that the desire to kill had to be burning through the nerves of his warriors, but they held back their fire. Not a single Vulkite beam or bolter shell leapt out to meet the descending enemy craft. Unopposed, the Ultramarines crashed down onto the surface of Cronus, 30 drop pods packed with vengeful warriors, 10 more unleashing clouds of missiles and blasts of plasma into the surrounding ruins. Gunships rained down fire as they circled, battering shells against the toppled walls and the reinforced ferrocrete of the bunkers.
"The time is at hand, my proud eaters of worlds,"
declared Eris, opening fire with his bolt of ambrace, while the Achilles spat forth death from its thunderfire cannon and multi-melters.
Let the enemy know our retort!
The World Eaters surge from dozens of cover positions, bolters and pistols barking, covered by heavy weapons fire from word bearers stationed at murder holes in the lower levels of the Templum. Suddenly surrounded by a mass of foes, the Ultramarines try to pull back into a defensive formation, the guns of the Thunderhawks overhead silenced by the short distance between both sides. Eris ran in, his chainsabers whirring as bolts from a charging Ultramarine sergeant sparked from his warplate. The sergeant had a short-bladed gladius in one hand, his pistol in the other. Diamond-edged chainblade teeth cut through his sword hand, scattering armored fingers. Eris's other weapon split the pistol's barrel, detonating the bolt in the chamber. Reeling from this, the sergeant took a step back. Eris ripped both blades free and drove them into the Ultramarine's chest, the spinning teeth chewing through the golden blazon and blue ceramite until they churned into bone and organs. Eris felt a jolt as his butcher's nails responded to the carnage unfolding around him. He snarled, taking in a short breath as he looked around. Brother versus brother, it mattered not. To fight his fellow legionaries was the ultimate test. If he was stronger than the best of them, then there was no other in the galaxy that could threaten him, save for the Primarchs themselves. He wove his blades in deadly arcs, sometimes together, sometimes apart, punctuating the moments of inactivity between foes with salvos from his vambrace. With each death, the gorging of his warrior spirit grew, and the nail's effect became more potent. His vision was turning red as combat stims coursed through his body, threatening to burst his gen-hanced veins. There was something else alongside the well-known euphoria of battle. There was a sense of release with each foe he killed. Every Ultramarine that fell was accompanied by a surge of power. It lingered along his blades with the blood, a miasma on the edge of sensation. The same was also true of every World Eater that died around him. Eris could almost feel something ephemeral, as though their very essence fled their cleaved bodies, trying to soar away, but caught in the thrall of the Templum Demonarchia. It occurred to him, as he struck the head from another foe, that perhaps Eliphas was trying to play him for a fool, luring him into sacrificing his warriors for some greater goal. The implant reached its perfect pitch, raw sensation and intellectual understanding meeting at an infinitely small point of balance. Everything was clear and pin sharp. Each flying drop of blood, each tooth on his sword blades, every scratch upon his armor. He saw the detonation of bolts and the trails of propellant behind them, felt the thunder of the Achilles' guns through his boots, smelled the blood and tasted the sweat on the air. For an exquisite instant, he teetered on the precipice, trying with every mote of his will to hold on to his sanity, lifted up above all other creatures in his moment of ecstatic accomplishment. And then he slipped over the summit and was dragged down into the mindless rage, all thought of grand plans and potential betrayal forgotten. From a skewed window a few meters above the base of the tower, Eliphas heard Eris' howls split the air. The World Eater was a blur of death, his armor sprayed with gore as he hacked his way into the heart of the Ultramarines' ranks. But as much as the 12th Legion fell upon the sons of Gilliman with reckless abandon, Eris had been true to his plan. He had positioned his warriors in such a way that there was a path to the Templum Demonarchia, and along this weakened axis the Ultramarines naturally moved, seeking both refuge from the berserk assault and also to silence the heavy guns of the word-bearers in the higher reaches.
"It's working!" crowed Yoth. "Can you feel it?"
"I can," replied Eliphas.
Like a rising flood, the immaterial energy was gathering in the foundations of the tower. It was drawn to the blood-soaked stones, built in ritual, arranged along the occult lines of confluence between realms. He slapped a hand to Yoth's shoulder plate.
"I can feel it, my learned friend. Your calculations are perfect."
The first of the Ultramarines reached the gate below, staggering into the cold interior as they turned and fired their bolters at the pursuing World Eaters. Eliphas gestured to Acton, who was waiting by a crude stairway to the left, the great icon across his shoulder.
"It is nearly time! With me, proud Sacrificia!"
The Wordbearer's commander raced down the steps and into the beleaguered Ultramarines. His mace left crimson trails of smoke as he smote left and right, cracking open armor and crushing helms. For all that he had labored to build the Templum for the glory of the Abyssal Citulate, it felt good to smite his enemies in person. The escaping soul stuff of the dead washed around him, the death cries and passing moans of the departed lingering in his hearing. As more legionaries died, the warp fluid became a tangible thing, a half-present cloud of fog that was spiraling up to the pinnacle of the Templum, guided by the swirl of dedicated corpses adorning the exterior, concentrating and solidifying, as though light passing through successive lenses, becoming sharper and more distinct as it spun higher.
"Now, Acton," he cried, "Immoria Magisterius Sanguinea!"
Eliphas's icon-bearer drove the sharpened heel of the stave through the chest of a dying Ultramarine, pinning the flailing legionary to the ground. The skulls flared with black fire, hurling Acton half a dozen meters across the floor of the Templum, as if he had been struck by lightning. His smoking warplate clattered to a stop against the far wall, cracked open as though something huge had burst out from within. Of the warrior that had worn the armor, nothing was visible. Set into the corpse of the Ultramarine, the standard started to shine with a dirty golden light that caused even Eliphas to flinch, averting his eyes from its blazing light. When he had recovered, he saw that the head of the icon was slowly starting to spin. The circle described by the orbiting skulls darkened, becoming a black disk that bowed outwards. Or, perhaps, inwards. The shining surface tricked the eye, making it seem both convex and concave at the same time. A face formed in the fluid-like blackness, a proud brow and unflinching eyes, lips pursed in agitation. The Abyssal Citulate. The incarnate entity of the all-changing ways, the guide of the blind, Lorgar, Aurelian. The Urizen, Primarch of the 17th Legion. Eliphas and the other Wordbearers threw themselves to their knees, all except the Inheritor averting their eyes.
"Lord, 1,000 humble thanks for your appearance," Eliphas called, holding out his hands in supplication. "You bless us with this visitation, but I beg more. Why do you not walk the bridge we have built? Why would you not pass through the golden arch we have erected in your honor?"
The Primarch's lips moved, and as they did, the skulls opened their jaws, mouthing in time to the words that issued from the icon, the voice bassy and distorted.
"Eliphas, what cause brings you to disturb me in this awkward fashion?"
"Cronus, revered lord, we beg your indulgence and your presence so that you might witness the holy slaughter. Bless us with your strong arm and sure command, I beseech you."
"Cronus, what of Cronus?"
"The 500 worlds burn in your name, Father of Truth. Cronus shall be lit like a pyre in your honor."
"The 500 worlds are of no concern to me any longer, Eliphas. I have achieved that which I sought when we came east."
Eliphas became aware that all had fallen quiet around him. He heard the tread of boots and glanced to his left to see Erez marching into the hall of the Templum. The glazed look in his eyes was fading, his gaze slowly focusing on the Wordbearers. Eliphas ignored him.
"But, my lord, Monarchia," Eliphas spluttered, "what of our retribution against the sons of Gilliman? Are the Ultramarines to be spared the anguish that their callous betrayal deserves?
The Ultramarines are no longer of any consequence. My brother Angron and his legion will hew their pitiful remains. All forces and expeditions of the Wordbearers are to reassemble on the Road of Stars to follow the Primus Naviclature to the recall point on Tarsaron.
Tarsaron? Eliphas's voice was almost a whimper. What of our works here? What of the great pyre?
Obey!
The image of the Primarch grimaced briefly, and then he was gone, the icon falling to dust across the body of the Ultramarine. Yoth rose to his feet and rounded on the commander.
That is our reward, Inheritor! That is the prize for all our labours!
The Abyssal Sigillate has spoken,
Eliphas replied, though his voice sounded as hollow as his heart felt.
The Shadow Crusade is no more. Vanished, like the great crusade before it. Lorgar commands. We follow.
We fought for Cronus.
You fought little,
said Eris, coming up behind Eliphas, his chainswords leaving bloody droplets on the crudely tiled floor.
Cronus belongs to me. You heard the words of your gene, sire.
Eliphas thought to argue, but he could see the last remnants of the implant still pushing murderous thoughts into the captain's brain. Outnumbered, facing direct orders from his Primarch, Eliphas had little option but to acquiesce to Eris's demand. He said nothing and started towards the archway that led from the tower. As he went, he heard Eris speaking to Yoth.
Why do you call him Inheritor?
It is how he came by the rank of chapter master, Yoth replied with a bitter laugh. During the Purge, he slew the previous leader of the Ark of Testimony and took his place. Lorgar did not elevate him, saying only that he had inherited his command. He never earned his place, and we will never let him forget it.
Eliphas ground his teeth. He had hoped that Cronus would seal his place in history and allow him to bargain for Lorgar's favor. He had failed. But it was not the end of his ambitions. Even if he had to throttle Kor Faeron and slay 1,000 worlds himself, he would get the respect he deserved. He walked out into the body-strewn surrounds of the Templum. Cronus was a stepping stone, as he had said, but now he knew that he could depend on the Primarch for nothing. The principles had been proven. Now he would enact his plans on a far grander scale. There would be a reckoning. When the time came, Eliphas swore to himself, Lorgar would finally take notice, and the name of the Inheritor would be known across the galaxy. Whether as a curse or blessing, he did not care.
That was Inheritor by Gav Thorpe, read by John Banks.